Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about Ricky Nelson. One-fourth of one of America's most wholesome families of the 1950s turned teen heartthrob rock and roll icon. This episode is dedicated to listener Kelly P., who reached out to me and suggested that I cover Ricky Nelson. She said there isn't much out there covering his life and legacy, so I am happy to take on the challenge in honoring his memory. Rick Nelson was born Eric Hilliard Nelson on May 8, 1940, to parents Ozzie and Harriet. Ozzie Nelson was already a very accomplished and well-loved band leader who had been topping the charts for 5 years already when Ricky was born, and Harriet sang in the band. Let's rewind a little before we move along to Ricky Nelson's life story, because he has a very unique situation that stands out from most of the other individuals that we talk about. Many of our stars are reaching for stardom as an escape from the life that they've known thus far. But Ricky Nelson was born into a world of entertainment. It was in his blood. Let me talk about his grandparents and parents a little before Ricky was even born, just so you can get an idea of what kind of world he was entering. Ricky Nelson's paternal grandparents, George and Ethel Nelson, were vaudevillian performers in a duet act during the turn of the century in New Jersey where they lived. They had two sons, Alfred and Oswald, or Ozzie. By the age of five, Ozzie Nelson was performing in his parents' act alongside his brother. After high school, Ozzie earned a scholarship to Rutgers University, where he studied law and played football. While in college, Ozzie's father died at just 48 years old, and his mother had a severe mental health break as a result. The couple's third son, Donald, was just a baby, so his care was left up to Ozzie and his older brother, Alfred. To help make money for his family and feed his musical desires at the same time, Ozzie Nelson became a band leader while studying to be a lawyer. When it came to the point where he couldn't juggle both law school and the band, he chose the band. Peggy Louise Snyder was also born to professional entertainers. The world would later know Peggy Louise Snyder as Harriet Nelson. Her parents were actors. Her father was an actor and director in traveling stock theater companies. Sometimes their daughter would be able to join them on the road and perform on stage as well. But mostly, little Peggy, or Harriet as we all know her, lived with family and at a Catholic boarding school. When her parents divorced in 1925, 16-year-old Peggy and her mother set off into a new life together in New York City. Here, Peggy became Harriet, and she went all in with acting and dance lessons, determined to have a life in show business. Within a year of arriving in New York, Harriet had appeared in a Broadway play and was performing heavily in the vaudeville and nightclub scene. Her granddaughter, Tracy, which is Rick's daughter, described this time perfectly. She said, quote, "She was a babe, and it was the 30s. She hung out at the Cotton Club and wore bias-cut dresses on the bandstand without any underwear because you couldn't wear underwear. You'd have panty lines. And she had platinum blonde hair and smoked Marlboros from the time she was 13. And she took care of herself, and she took care of her mom. And she knew how to take care of herself, end quote. Remember, this is America's most perfect ideal mother, Harriet Nelson, that we're talking about. Her granddaughter was right, though. She was a babe. She was gorgeous. Harriet was married once before she became the other half of Ozzie and Harriet. She was married to a vaudevillian performer, but not for long. She left after 1 year. Her fate was set on New Year's Eve 1931 when she performed alongside the Ozzie Nelson Orchestra. A few months later, she was singing in the band. And then she and Ozzie fell in love. They got married in 1935. And 1 week after Ozzie and Harriet said I do, she left New York for Hollywood to make her big screen debut. The movie? Follow the Fleet, starring Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. And another future 1950s television superstar also appeared in this movie, Lucille Ball. Harriet's role was that of the love interest of Randolph Scott's character, a role that was supposed to be played by Irene Dunne. After becoming a film star, Harriet returned to her husband in New York, had a baby, David, then went right back to RKO in Hollywood just 2 months after giving birth to David. By the following year, the whole young family would be living in Hollywood. They and the band had a gig on a radio show called Seeing Stars, basically Ozzie and Harriet shooting the breeze with celebrities. Just a few little names they chatted with on their radio program were Humphrey Bogart, Bela Lugosi, Ida Lupino, and Walt Disney. And then they spent 3 seasons on the Red Skelton radio show. Their orchestra was highly successful, scoring 38 hits during its entire 14-year run. So this is the kind of life Ricky Nelson and his brother David were born into. On May 8, 1940, when Eric Hilliard Nelson was born, he was thrust into a life so unconventional, but in the best possible way. His parents were in a successful band, and their extended family was the rest of the orchestra, their wives, and their children. It was a life on the road and a life filled with artists. It was a good life. Unconventional and good. The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet radio show debuted on October 8, 1944, Ozzie and Harriet's 9th wedding anniversary, and it took inspiration from the family's own lives. Ricky and his brother David were part of the show, but only as characters. The boys were portrayed by teenage actors on the radio show, at first at least. 5 years into the show, in 1949, Ozzie thought his boys were ready to step into the action themselves. And 9-year-old Ricky Nelson was an instant hit on the airwaves. Everyone loved him. Everyone loved the entire Nelson family. The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet radio show was insanely popular. The Nelsons were one of the most famous and most beloved families in the United States. In 1951, 7 years into the series, the family hit the big screen in Here Come the Nelsons. Their radio fans were thrilled to see them instead of just hearing them. By 1952, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet had been dominating the radio waves for 8 years. But big things were changing in the form of home entertainment. Move over radio. TV was the new boss in town. The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet made the exciting transition from radio onto television screens on October 3, 1952, with the entire family of four as the stars of the show. Ricky was 12 years old, and his brother David was just shy of his 16th birthday. Seasoned fans of the radio show were over the moon with happiness in finally being able to watch their favorite comedy come to life every week. Ricky Nelson was, by now, a name known by the entire nation. The Nelson family was even more unconventional now, which is highly ironic considering they played the most conventional family imaginable on their television show. In reality, though, their lives were completely centered around the show. Ozzy and Harriet had negotiated complete artistic control over their television show, and they kept very busy with all aspects of putting out episodes. They tried their best to keep as typical of a life as possible for their sons. They always had dinner together, and the boys did go to regular public school, for a while at least. But that large orchestra family had been replaced by an even larger television crew family. Greater than that, they were wildly public figures. But it was really all Ricky Nelson knew. It was the life that he was born into. That didn't make it easy all of the time, though. Eventually, the demands of the show became so much that the boys stopped going to public school. And then, the strict morals clause became more difficult to adhere to as the boys grew. I mean, imagine having to hold up to such intense perfection. Having to maintain that ideal perfect persona that you're playing on television. When you're a teenage boy that almost every girl in America is in love with. Ozzie Nelson laid into his son a massive guilt trip. If they mess up and ruin the show, they are sending over 40 people into the unemployment line and their entire families will suffer and go hungry. That's a lot to live up to as a kid. Morals clause or not, Rick still managed to lose his virginity at only 14 years old while the family was vacationing in Europe. And from the sounds of it, with a much older girl, maybe even a grown woman. His brother David was more concerned with pleasing their father and following the rules. Rick, not so much. He was going to live his life and take advantage of his perfect physical appearance and the opportunities it and fame provided him. Ricky Nelson had a love for music since he was a toddler. He could be found lying under the family's large radio console listening to classical music before he could even walk. As he grew, so did his love for music, both listening to it and making it. Ricky saw his future clear as day when, in 1955, he heard the wild new sounds of Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins. 2 years later, when he was 16 years old, Ricky convinced his father to allow him to sing a song during the sound check before the Ozzy and Harriet show. Shortly later, on April 10, 1957, Ricky Nelson first performed as a musician on television on the family's show, singing the Fats Domino song, I'm Walkin'. And just like that, Ricky Nelson was one of the hottest teen idols in the United States. That first song shot straight to number 4 on the charts, and his singing became a regular thing on the family television show. Ricky Nelson was much more fortunate than most young men trying to become rock and roll superstars. He was already famous, and he had a father who had also been a famous musician and was also a keen businessman. He had an in, a step up from the others. Ozzie Nelson, always knowing the best direction to take in business, made sure that his son's albums were already stocked at record stores before he debuted any of his songs on the family television show. That way, when everyone fell in love with Ricky's new songs, they could run right down to the record store and grab it. Ricky Nelson's debut album went all the way to number 1. Ricky Nelson eventually sold 60 million albums. Even in the UK, he achieved 19 top 40 hits. The UK didn't even get the pleasure of watching his family's popular sitcom, The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet. They didn't love him because he was in a television show as a child. They loved him for him and his music. If you don't believe me, take Paul McCartney's word for it. Over in England, we knew nothing about the Nelson show, Ozzy and Harriet. To us, he was the famous one in the family, McCartney said. Ricky gathered up some other musical talent and put together a band right away, and they toured during the Ozzy and Harriet Show season breaks. Most new rock and roll acts of the time performed primarily on TV variety shows like The Steve Allen Show or The Ed Sullivan Show, but Ricky Nelson and Elvis Presley were a little different. They took their acts on the road and performed as single acts. Ricky Nelson, and Elvis as we all know, was a wild superstar during the late 1950s. Every teenage girl in America was going wild over him. All of this is happening while a slightly older generation of Americans was still wild about watching their favorite family on their television screens each week. In 1959, The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet was renewed for another 5 years. The show was very popular on its own, but ABC was eager to capitalize on the music success of youngest son, Ricky Nelson. They had some competition on the small screen now as other wholesome family shows popped up on television, like My Three Sons and Leave It to Beaver. Rick Nelson reached a little further away from the perfect youngest son of the perfect American family in 1959 when he starred in the Western film Rio Bravo alongside John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Angie Dickinson. His older brother David was doing the same, starting with Peyton's Place. Both of them were doing what they could do to make sure that they didn't get trapped in that perfect little polished boy image. But Rick always felt like he couldn't quite get to the same place as his musical peers. He always felt like perfect little Ricky Nelson from TV was holding him back. In 1957, 17-year-old Rick Nelson had met 12-year-old Kristen Harmon at a basketball game. Kristen, like most 12-year-old girls in America, had a huge crush on Ricky Nelson. Her parents were semi-famous, her father being a Heisman Trophy recipient and celebrated World War II fighter pilot, and her mom was a retired actress. Kristen's brother was future NCIS star Mark Harmon. Rick waited a few years, thank goodness, but Kristen's dreams came true when every girl's hunky idol asked her on a date. He was 20 and she was 15. A couple years later, they got married on April 20th, 1963. Kristen was only 17 when they got married and 3 months pregnant. Baby Tracy Nelson was born on October 25th, 1963, also a future actress. 23-year-old Ricky Nelson was now a father, and Ozzy and Harriet were grandparents. Ricky's daughter Tracy spoke on the biography documentary I watched as part of my research, and she said her grandfather, Ozzy Nelson, of course did not want the world knowing that his perfect son had had sex before he was married. The ideal family name could absolutely not be tarnished like that. So, allegedly, he convinced the hospital to change the birth certificate a bit and put baby Tracy in an incubator when she didn't need to be, to act as though she was a preemie. The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet was on forever. America had a front row seat to watching Ricky and David Nelson grow from boys into grown, married fathers. The wholesomeness of the Nelson family was a beloved part of 50s American culture. But watch out, 1950s. Here comes the 1960s shoving their way in and getting that wholesome ideal lifestyle all riled up. Huge cultural changes began to stir as the 1960s got underway. And this wasn't necessarily great news for the Nelson family. More realistic and complex stories were popping up on television, and a new quartet of young men from Liverpool, named Paul, John, Ringo, and George, popped up in the music world and made teenage American girls say, "Ricky who?" It was the beginning of a new era, and that means it was the end of another. The final episode of The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet was filmed on January 1st, 1966. ABC filled their time slot with Batman. Their final episode was episode number 435. The adventures of Ozzie and Harriet filled American living rooms for 21 years between radio and television. The 1960s totally wiped out the entire idea the Nelson family had based their success on. It was time for a new chapter for all of them, and they all made their way into new endeavors. Rick was 25 years old when the show ended. This had been his entire life. Such a huge part of his identity. Almost all of his identity. Imagine coming out the other side of that and trying to figure out how to proceed, where to go next. The thing that Rick Nelson always kept coming back to, what he felt in his soul since he was a small child, was music. But could he still be taken seriously as a musician in a world now dominated by the sounds of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Doors, Jimi Hendrix, and Pink Floyd? Well, he was gonna try. Rick Nelson and the Stone Canyon Band came onto the scene with a virtually unrecognizable lead singer. Gone was the straight-laced boy with the always fresh haircut, wearing a pressed jacket and tie. In his place was a bushy 60s hair and sideburned man in a vest and bell-bottoms. And he was singing country rock instead of pop. And people did like it. Not everyone, but many did. He achieved a top 10 hit in this revival period with Garden Party in 1971. He wrote this song in response to being booed at the Madison Square Garden 50s Revival Garden Party concert. The chorus of the song is, "But it's all right now, I've learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you've got to please yourself." If you're a fan of dissecting pop culture, subscribe and listen to Pop Culture 5 with Jeremy Dove and Thomas Senna. Jeremy and Thomas take any given pop culture topic and break it down to its five essentials. Anything from five essential Tom Hanks movies to five essential Seinfeld episodes. Do you love music? Jeremy and Thomas cover artists ranging from Beyoncé to the Rolling Stones. Have some fun and play along with them. You can listen to Pop Culture 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Rick and Kristen welcomed twin boys, Gunnar and Matthew, on September 20th, 1967. Those are the Nelsons that I grew up with in pop culture. And then son Sam was born in 1970. In October of 1974, Ozzie Nelson was diagnosed with terminal liver cancer. He declined rapidly, losing a whopping 70 pounds in 6 months. Just 8 months after he was first diagnosed, Ozzie Nelson died on June 3, 1975, at only 69 years old. Ozzie was the glue that held his family together, a true familial patriarch. And now he was gone. And not everyone in the family handled that very well. Rick's former wife, Kristen, described her husband as the perfect father when their children were young. But a lot had changed in his life and career by the time his father died in the mid-70s. His focus became more on his career as a musician than on his family, and there were a lot of resentments at home. There was cocaine, alcohol, and infidelity all around. And their kids were often stuck in the middle of the ugliness. "Rick and I were both leading unhealthy lives," Kristen recalled of this time. "And I really had a feeling that either both of us would die or one of us would die if someone didn't leave. We were very, very self-destructive." Kristen left in October of 1980 and filed for divorce after 17 years of marriage. She had been with him her entire teenage and adult life, but the marriage was far too destroyed to ever be repaired. 4 months after Kristen left, a woman named Georgianne Crew gave birth to a baby she named Eric. The baby's father was Rick Nelson. The divorce tore the Nelson family apart. Oldest child Tracy stayed with her father, She was 17 when they first separated. The twins, 13 years old, stayed with their mother. And youngest child Sam, 10, stayed with neither. After his parents separated, Sam was raised by his maternal grandparents, the Harmons. And then his uncle Mark Harmon, of NCIS fame, sued his sister Kristen for custody of Eric due to her drug use. This reality couldn't be more off the rails from the idealistic family picture of Ozzie and Harriet from just a generation prior. The twins, Gunnar and Matthew, gravitated back towards their father when they turned 18 in 1985. They both had something in common with their dad, a love and talent for music. The boys moved in with Rick and lived more like roommates than father and sons as they entered into adulthood. Rick Nelson was a man who never really figured out how to grow up. He was youth trapped in an aging body, and having his actual youthful sons around was kind of refreshing. He loved seeing their passion for music and was excited to see where it could take them. On the evening of Christmas that year, 1985, while the three men were talking in the kitchen, Rick said to his sons, "You know, I just want to let you both know, I don't just love you as my sons, but I admire you as my peers." It was a truly special moment that had them all in tears. A moment Gunnar and Matthew would never forget. Especially since their father would be dead just 1 week later. On December 31st, 1985, New Year's Eve, Ricky Nelson's private plane was traveling from Guntersville, Alabama, to Dallas, Texas, when it crash-landed outside of DeKalb, Texas, bursting into flames. The pilot and co-pilot miraculously survived the crash, but all seven of the passengers, including Rick Nelson, died. Rick Nelson was dead at just 45 years old. I want to take a little time to talk about the plane crash that killed Rick Nelson, his girlfriend, and his band members. When I recently told my mom that I was researching Ricky Nelson, she said, "Oh, the way he died was just so tragic. It was such a big deal when it happened." I admitted I did not know how he died. I really didn't know very much about him at all before I dove into my research. So she told me that the fire that led to the plane crash was somehow caused by drugs on board the plane. I was horrified and intrigued, but I didn't look it up, not yet. I like to let my stories unfold naturally and chronologically during my research. If I don't know how or when an individual dies, I keep myself in suspense through the entire book I'm reading for my research. To me, it makes for a more emotional journey, and having a more emotional journey makes me feel very connected to these people. And that makes me feel like I can give you a better story. By the time I get to the end of someone's life, I'm so emotionally invested in them that it leaves a pretty big impact. I get to know these people through the intimate biographies and autobiographies that I read about them. And I'm always so sad when I get to the end. Well, most of the time. Cough, cough, Louis B. Mayer. So I didn't dive into Rick Nelson's death until I got there naturally in learning his story myself. And what I learned really surprised me. And then made me kind of mad. There is absolutely no evidence that the plane crash that killed Rick Nelson and six others was caused by freebasing cocaine or any other drug-related reason. But that is the legacy that was left behind. My mom is proof of that. She remembers it being all over the news in 1985. I can just hear Dan Rather's voice filling our living room with the news, while I obliviously played with my My Little Ponies on our brown shag carpet. And then Harry Smith repeating the shocking news the next morning while I waited 45 long minutes for my piping hot Malto meal to cool down. And then, later that night, seeing all but my dad's face because it was blocked by the newspaper that he religiously read every night, also reading about the probably false details of the crash. The very important detail about the fire being caused by the plane's occupants freebasing cocaine was a sensationalized detail created by the media. Mom, I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at the media. The truth did eventually come out, but the media didn't care to make a huge deal about it because it just wasn't as exciting of a headline as a cocaine-induced plane crash. So a lot of people just never really learned the truth. It just proves to us how powerful the media is in our perception of the truth. This is important now more than ever. My mom remembers clearly the shocking death of Rick Nelson, and she remembers clearly all of the news outlets, TV and print, reporting the crash being caused by freebasing cocaine. Many of you probably also remember this moment in history. What would you say if someone asked you what caused Rick Nelson's plane crash? Going from what you remember from the news. Let me tell you what the investigation proved. Rick Nelson's private plane was a big old DC-3, an old World War II era passenger plane built in 1944. It was previously owned by Jerry Lee Lewis, and it had a recent history of concerning engine problems. The DC-3 was non-pressurized and used onboard heaters for temperature control in the cabin. These heaters were gasoline-fired, inside of the airplane. As the aircraft experts from the Flight Safety Detectives podcast said, the DC-3 was a very reliable but unforgiving airplane. According to the NTSB investigation following the crash of Rick Nelson's airplane, there had been no documented inspections of the plane. The NTSB report states next to the section that says last known inspection as unknown. That's not to say no inspection occurred, but there was no documentation of it happening. When things started going wrong on Rick Nelson's plane 3 hours and 8 minutes into the flight, the pilot communicated that he was going to circle the plane back and make an emergency landing in Texarkana. There was smoke in the plane. I think I'd like to turn around, head for Texarkana, pilot Brad Rink said. I've got a little problem. 2 minutes later, he radioed that they wouldn't make it to the airport. They would have to attempt an emergency landing in a field. 3 minutes after that communication, the plane landed into a Texas field and burst into flames. The pilot and co-pilot were the sole survivors of the crash, and they had conflicting accounts of what happened. The pilot said that he left the controls to the co-pilot while he went back into the cabin to investigate smoke coming from the rear of the cabin, that he touched the inboard heater and that it was cool to the touch at that time, and that he activated an automatic fire extinguisher and opened the cabin's fresh air intakes before returning to the cockpit. The co-pilot's account was a little different. He said that the passengers had requested heat in the cabin during the flight, so he switched on the cabin heater from his cockpit controls. He said the overheat light came on several times, and each time it did, the pilots turned the cabin heater off, let it cool down, and then would turn it back on again. He said the pilot, Rank, went to the heater to see what was going on with it. After several of these overheat alerts, the co-pilot refused to turn it on again because something was obviously wrong. I refused to turn it on, he recalled. I was getting more nervous. I didn't think we should be messing with that heater on route, end quote. After he and Rank escaped the burning plane on the ground, he claims Rank told him to not tell anyone about the faulty heater. All of the passengers' bodies were found at the front of the cabin. They were trying desperately to get out of the airplane. The NTSB found fault in pilot Brad Rank not following protocol with the in-flight fire checklist. He opened the fresh air vents when he should have left them closed. He did not instruct passengers to use oxygen. And he did not try to extinguish the fire with a handheld fire extinguisher. According to the NTSB, following these steps would have enhanced the potential for a safer landing and survival of the passengers. I read the actual NTSB Aviation Investigation Final Report, and it does outline the situation with the heater, but next to reason for occurrence, it reads undetermined. There was no mention in the official report of drugs. Nothing. Small amounts of cocaine were later found in Rick Nelson's system. I'm not going to deny his use of drugs. His drug use was pretty well known. But not every drug user deserves to die a horrific death. And there is no evidence at all that anyone on board that aircraft was using a lighter or match during flight. But once one news outlet reported this highly gripping headline that using drugs caused the deadly crash, it, pardon the expression, spread like wildfire. And that is the account many people remember about how Ricky Nelson died. Rick's mother, Harriet, his brother, David, and all four of his children learned about their son, brother, and father's tragic death on television and radio special reports on that New Year's Eve that forever changed all of their lives. By the time Ozzie Nelson had died in 1974, Rick had become pretty distanced from his brother and mother. After Ozzie's death, Ricky only saw Harriet and David on holidays. But Ricky would always be Harriet's little boy. She had lost her sparkle the day Ozzie died, and when Ricky died so tragically, she was absolutely devastated. David took very good care of Harriet until her death at the age of 85 in 1994. And he also made sure his brother Rick's four children were taken care of by straightening up the financial mess left behind by his brother. Something they are all truly grateful for. David Nelson, it seems, became the fresh glue that held the Nelson family together when Ozzie left the world. Rick Nelson always said he didn't see himself growing old. Maybe somehow he just knew he wouldn't be on this earth very long. I'm going to end with a quote from his son Matthew. He lived three lives in that one short life that he had. And now I would like to share some interesting things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. The last song Ricky Nelson performed in his life was Buddy Holly's song, Rave On. Both men died in plane crashes after singing the same song. Bullet point number two. Ricky Nelson's song, Poor Little Fool, was the very first song to top the Billboard Top 100 at its induction in 1958. Bullet point number three. Ricky Nelson was voted the 91st greatest rock and roll artist of all time by Rolling Stone. Bullet point number four. Ricky Nelson had television's very first music video with the song Travelin' Man. Ozzie included Ricky performing the song on the family show, which wasn't new. But what was new was incorporating images into the performance to support the song's story. Bullet point number five. I mentioned this in my Errol Flynn episode too, but Rick Nelson purchased Flynn's uniquely custom home that was filled with peepholes and secret passageways and mirrors all over the walls and ceilings. If those mirrors could talk, huh? I just think it's funny that Rick Nelson kept those mirrors up. Bullet point number six. Rick Nelson's twin sons, Gunnar and Matthew, were famous rock stars for a bit themselves. This was from my youth and the first famous Nelsons I really knew. I remember being so jealous of their gorgeous long blonde hair. And I can recall their music video for After the Rain so vividly. We watched a lot of MTV. I loved Nelson, and I remember begging my parents to go see them when they were touring and being so mad when they said I couldn't go. I was 9 years old. Good call, Mom and Dad. In conclusion, Rick Nelson was born into a legacy of show business. He had entertainment blood running through his veins, and there was very little chance his destiny would involve anything other than a life in show business. He grew up completely in the spotlight. His every action was observed and analyzed. He was under extreme pressure to be perfect in every way. He was a crucial element to one of America's most idealistic families. Maybe this is why he took such a radical turn in his adult life, going from America's most perfect child and teenage boy to a hard-drinking, partying, drug-using adult who spent more time on the road than with his family at home. A family life so far removed from the family life that had made him famous. His lifestyle, though, as it turned out, didn't matter when it came to his death. Or it shouldn't have mattered. By all official accounts, his drug use had nothing to do with the plane fire that led to his death. Nothing. But sadly, that is the legacy left behind in so many people's minds. Drugs are bad. Don't do them. Drugs can lead to a lot of bad things. But I don't think they led to this bad thing. Let's remember Ricky Nelson for his wholesome years on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, and for his numerous hits as he quite literally helped introduce the world to rock and roll. And let's also take this story as a reminder to always read more than one source when gathering our current news. And always, please always, read beyond the sensationalized headlines. So many people today get their information from misleading headlines without reading the actual content of an article. And this can be so damaging. Information is powerful. Thank you, Rick Nelson, for sacrificing your childhood for the entertainment of the American people. Thank you for helping guide in the new and exciting genre of music that completely transformed the music world. And thank you all for listening. Before I go, I want to share a review of the week. This came in the form of a really lovely email I received from listener Terry. Part of what Terry said was, quote, "I want to congratulate you on your podcast. You sound young and it gives me hope that someone of your generation is interested in these stars and this era. I just found your podcast, but I'm addicted and love how thorough your research has been," end quote. Thank you, Terry. I had a really nice conversation with Terry, and she gave me some great recommendations for future episodes that she'd like to hear. And Terry, I do have one coming up very soon. And as far as keeping these life stories alive for newer generations, that's definitely my goal. I'm not super young, I'm 45. But I would love to reach the ears of a wider 20-something and 30-something audience because I do think it's really important to keep these legacies alive. So I plan to keep on trucking and I'll be working on more promotional stuff this winter to try to get those young people in. Thank you so much, Terry. Please don't forget to rate and review the show where you listen to your podcasts. And follow the show on Facebook and Instagram. Shoot me a message anytime. If you want to throw a little support to the show and get some sweet bonus content in return, head on over to patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast to learn more. Thanks, guys. Have a great rest of your week. For this episode, I used an A&E biography special from June 21st, 1998. Episode 250 of Flight Safety Detectives from December 18th, 2024, CaseyJerry.com, and Wikipedia.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners. Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.